I'd like now to welcome Eric Tonesmeyer. He is author of the book Paradise Lot, Two Plant Geeks, One-Tenth of an Acre, and the Making of an Edible Garden Oasis in the City. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
It's great to have you here. And this is such an interesting story. I mean, there's a lot about plants and urban gardening, and it's also really the story of your life. You got interested in plants and ecosystems really early on. How did that interest develop, and how did you develop it?
Well, you know, I was very fortunate that when I was in, among lots of great things my parents did and so on, I was fortunate that I was in a program at a local nature center when I was in fifth grade, where we spent a week out there at their site, and every day we would go and sit quietly in the same spot for half an hour or something and draw pictures or talk about what we observed. And somehow that just really drew me in. And I was, again, fortunate right after high school to be able to go and spend almost a year working there and do the same work with young people. So that was very, very fortunate. It was very fun. And I also found out about permaculture while I was there, which is sort of about not just observing ecosystems and keeping your hands off them, but actively engaging to create these food-producing ecosystems. And that excited me so much that that's what I've spent my whole life doing.
Permaculture is such an interesting concept, and there's a lot of things that go into it, and I think a lot of people have different definitions for permaculture, but the term comes from permanent agriculture and permanent culture. And one of the things that I love about permaculture is it's basically, how do you set up ecosystems that feed you and also basically take the least amount of maintenance possible?
Absolutely. I find I have plenty of other things to do besides garden. So I like to get things set up so that it works relatively low maintenance once it's established. And we've had some really good success with that here, and also some definite proof that we can't do it with zero maintenance yet at all. But it's been, for example, we have some crops that come back. We have a perennial broccoli that's now 12 years old. Comes back every year, makes broccoli. We barely have to do anything for it at all. And I like that. When you can set a bunch of things in motion like that, then you have this very low maintenance, perpetual food producing machine. That's nice.
Somebody called it, you go from designer to recliner.
Yes. And unfortunately, there's still a fair amount of harvesting involved, and you really can't get away from that. I think that's the irreducible minimum of low-maintenance gardening, is you still have to do plenty of harvesting. You can't get around it.
Well, of course, the big part is the designing of a permaculture garden. And in the book, Paradise Lot, you talk about kind of how you got to this place where you and your friend Jonathan Bates bought a duplex in Holyoke, Massachusetts, and a tiny, I mean, tenth of an acre really is a pretty small space, started a permaculture garden there. And the thing that's really, to me, just like rocket science about permaculture is that it's not only learning about each plant. It's learning about how they interact with each other. It's about learning about the insects and worms that affect them. And basically, each part of the system is connected to every other. And that is something that you can't just learn through brute force. It really takes a lot of different kinds of learning.
And that, for us, that's been interesting. Some of it's been book learning. You know, I've combed through many, many, many books on plants and ecology and agroecology and so on. But we also spend a lot of time with observation, setting up a chair out in the garden and watching the insects on the different kinds of flowers to see which ones the beneficial insects prefer, and rolling over logs and seeing what's crawling around under there. And so we try and really engage in that information as much as we can. And permaculture is about taking our understanding of, in this case, the plants, but it can be whatever elements you're trying to put together, looking at for each one, what its niche is, what does it need, what does it produce, what are the conditions it wants to be in, and trying to plug those pieces together to create a living ecosystem. where every piece is getting what it needs, and its products are being put to good use by somebody else, and it's in the ideal conditions for itself to be as happy as it can possibly be. And so we have plants that fix nitrogen, and we have plants that attract beneficial insects, and we have plants that are a preferred egg-laying site or overwintering site for beneficial insects. We have plants that like shade, and we have plants that like sun, and we're trying to put all those things together, and you end up with a lot of different layers of things happening all at once. It's really interesting. It's very, very fun.
It sort of reminded me when you were talking about, one of the ways that you guys do pest control is having beneficial insects that eat the bad insects. And for all the world, it really is also the way we work. We have all kinds of bacteria inside of ourselves that eat the bad bacteria, so to speak. And it just made me think that the ecosystem of our bodies and the ecosystems around us are very similar.
They much, much more than we tend to think, and I've been reading some studies lately on what they call the human microbiome, all the different kinds of organisms that live in our digestive tract, and there are an awful lot of parallels to the soil ecosystem, for example. I find that
right.
Really very, very interesting. And in our garden, we haven't sprayed anything at all for 6 and now going on 7 years. Not even anything organic. We just don't spray. And we have a few things that are problematic, like slugs in a wet year are bad for us, and occasionally some beetles. But we don't have any trouble with aphids. We don't have any trouble with caterpillars. There's just whole classes of insects that we don't have problems with. And even when we had recently, for the first time, spider mites showed up, which are really devastating. They came through and they ate almost everything. They ate many different kinds of crops. Then we kind of sat there and we said, oh, should we kill these things? Should we spray them? What are we going to do? We're reading about them, learning about their life cycle. Meanwhile, something shows up called a spider mite destroyer, which is a tiny little black ladybug. And within a couple weeks, all the spider mites were gone. Ever since then, we have a persistent, very low level of spider mites and spider mite destroyers. So they've just become part of the ecosystem. And that tells me that we've created something here that has some resilience, some ability to bounce back and take care of itself.
And one of the things that's interesting about that is the spider mite destroyers, you didn't have to order them. They just showed up by themselves.
They just showed up. And in fact, they eat some things besides spider mites. So it may be that some of them were already here eating some of the low level of aphids that we have. Or maybe they were here for all the nectar on all the different flowers we have. But we created conditions for them by providing habitat, providing water, providing nectar, and not spraying. It was really cool when it happened. We were scared we were going to lose everything, but it worked out very nicely.
We're talking to Eric Tonesmeyer about his book, Paradise Lot, Two Plant Geeks, One-Tenth of an Acre, and the Making of an Edible Garden Oasis in the City. Now, one of the things that we talk about when we talk about the evils of corporate agriculture is monoculture. Let's talk about what you do, which is polyculture. What does that mean?
Well, there's a couple different ways to do polyculture. One is, let's say in the same garden you might have a row of tomatoes and then a row of cabbages and then a row of something else, and that would be what we would call intercropping, where you're growing sort of little monocultures right next to each other of different species. And we do some of that, but we're also really looking at a true polyculture where the plants are growing right in with each other, and you try and line that up to have a maximum of cooperation between them and a minimum of competition. So you need to know what they need and what they can offer in order to do that properly. And I would say we're to the point now, after all these years, where we have a 50% success rate with new polycultures we've designed. So a lot of them don't work, and that's fine. You can try another one the next year. We've had success with a bunch, and we actually created a wiki online where people can share their results doing that, which has been a lot of fun to see what people are trying.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the amazing ways that permaculture works, is that any new technology, like having a polyculture wiki site, helps everybody, no matter how close or far away they are, be part of this community of ever more effective gardening.
And we're doing our best to share our mistakes. We put a lot of mistakes in the book, too. We try and be honest about all the things we did wrong, or we knew better than to do, and we did, and they didn't work, and all the things we were sure would work and were terrible disasters. And I think sharing that kind of information, the way that I like to think about that, is that we patent all of our mistakes, but we open source all of our successes. And that's how the movement moves forward, right? We have to be honest about what we get right and what we don't get right, so we can share that and move on and make new and interesting mistakes, more interesting mistakes.
Another term that you use in the book is forest gardening. What does that mean?
Well, we live here in the region of the Great Eastern Deciduous Forest, and we are attempting in our gardening to mimic some of the things that happen in a real forest, some of the structures like we might have in some areas, trees and then shrubs underneath them, and then herbaceous perennials underneath that, maybe some vines in there and some fungi. We're also, so that's some about the layers. We're also looking at the kinds of relationships between plants that happen in a real forest, like we were talking about for beneficial insects and nitrogen fixation and other fertility efforts, and some weed-suppressing living mulch ground covers. And finally, we look at the successional processes that happen in a forest where things change over time, and you might start with bare soil and end up with the great big trees and full shade 10 years later. So we have some areas where we're doing that pretty successfully here, like a persimmon tree with a couple of very nice shade tolerant berries growing underneath, and a beautiful diverse collection of shade tolerant perennial vegetables and beneficial insect plants growing under that, and then shiitake logs in there too. And out in New Mexico, that would look a little different. You'd be using different species, but the same process applies wherever you might be. You look to the natural ecosystems that occur where you are and figure out how much of that you can mimic, including directly incorporating useful native species from your area. And we grow quite a number of useful native species here in our own garden.
The question of native versus non-native species is quite a controversial one in terms of people who are doing permaculture gardening, and there's a lot of, you know, reasonable argument on both sides, but you have a very interesting take on using non-native species in your garden, and it has to do with food and carbon footprint.
Yeah, well, I mean, the first thing I would say is we always want to try and start with the useful native plants of your area before you go looking outside. So for us, that means persimmon, and it means pawpaw and some native nitrogen fixers and groundnuts and some other fun things. But what you'll typically find is that the native flora is not sufficient to feed you in its current state of domestication. And when our food is coming from, let's say here in the Northeast, your orange juice is also coming from Brazil, where there's huge monocultures of citrus in Brazil, which is where most of our orange juice comes from now. So if you want to grow some fruit, in our case, the hardy kiwi, that's very high in vitamin C, you're de-externalizing the ecological cost of your food production. So there's an ecological cost of cutting down all those ecosystems to put all that citrus in, and then there's a huge carbon footprint to ship that orange juice here, the orange juice concentrate here, from Brazil. So we need to look at these non-native plants not only in terms of the potential ecological cost of growing them, but we need to look at the ecological benefit of growing them, or even the ecological cost of not growing them.
Right.
I think if we look at the native plant garden has been held up as the highest example of the ecological garden, but if it's not growing food and your food comes from the supermarket, you're still part of the problem.
Exactly. And I think it's also important to talk about the reality that not every, you know, all these non-native species, they're not all harmful or invasive.
There are a lot, you know, something like only, is it 1 or 2 or 3% of non-native species ever become invasive. Mostly they
don't.
Exactly. And, you know, eventually over time, one of those species becomes a native species. The issue is that might take 10,000 years, and it might grow through a very annoying growth spurt phase And when you have a whole lot of species all doing that at the same time in the context of a very fragmented ecosystem and climate change, it creates problems. But the real problem to me is human disturbance of the environment that these plants are mostly responding to. Now, would I ever grow kudzu on purpose? I don't think so. If I lived out where you folks are, would I plant Russian olive? Probably not. But I think this fantasy that we can have native plant gardens and we're helping the environment when our food is coming from the global food system is problematic to me.
So meanwhile, some of the food that you are growing, a lot of the food that you are growing is what you call perennial vegetables. Now, I never even thought about the difference between annual and perennial vegetables since I don't grow my own vegetables. What is the difference and what are some examples of each one?
Sure. Well, most of the vegetables we eat are annual vegetables. So tomatoes would be a great example, or lettuce, where you have to plant seed every year. The plant grows. And then in the case of tomatoes is an easy example. The tomatoes grow, then you can pick the tomatoes, and the next year, no tomatoes will grow there. Maybe some rotted on the ground and a few sprout. But essentially, tomatoes won't grow there again the next year. You have to save the seed and plant it again, or buy more seeds and plant them again. That's an annual vegetable. It only lives 1 year. Whereas a perennial vegetable will keep coming back every year on its own, from a bigger and bigger root system every year. And that's a very desirable trait because it means you don't have to replant and the plant gets to start out with a healthy, robust root system in the first place, which makes it much tougher than a brand new, tiny little 2-inch high seedling of something annual. And that's a real benefit. And there's tons of different species of perennial vegetables. I wrote a book that has about 100 species in it. There are many, 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 many more that didn't make the cut into the book. Not all of them taste great. Not all of them are ready for prime time. And part of what we've been doing here is figuring out which ones we like and which ones grow well for us here. Because we have in our garden about 70 species of perennial edible leaves. And that's a lot. That's a lot of diversity.
Yeah, especially on this very small plot that you have. Now, that is a story in itself. By the way, we are talking to Eric Tonesmeyer, author of the book Paradise Lot. So that story of your two plant geeks, as you call yourselves, and the 1/10 of an acre is so interesting because your friend Jonathan Bates, who also contributed to this book, is a guy who was just as interested as you in ecosystems, and he'd come from marine biology and was really now more into plants and farming. And the two of you decided that you wanted to create an urban garden and not live kind of out in the countryside anymore. Why did you decide that, and how did you choose the city that you ended up in?
Well, okay, the crassest version of why we wanted to move is it was very hard to meet sweethearts out in the middle of nowhere. And we were getting older and wanted to find people to settle down with, and that wasn't happening out in the country. But we also really felt, and we wanted to find a duplex with a shared backyard so we could plant fruit trees and so on and continue to garden together, but eventually each have our own side of the house. And that's worked out really well. That's worked out great. We both have our sweeties, we both have babies, and we continue to share the garden and have fun back there. So that's been a really good arrangement. We chose this city partly because I'd been working here in urban agriculture since 1994. With an organization called Nuestras Raíces, which means our roots. This is one of the sort of national hotbeds of urban agriculture, so we were very interested in that. It also happened to be a very affordable city, and we felt like picking a small piece of land like this, the backyard is only 90 by 45, and that's most of the gardening space. We felt like that would enable what we're doing to be relevant to lots and lots of people. Whereas if we did something on 100 acres, not as many people have 100 acres as have 10 acres.
Right. And what was so interesting, I mean, this town, Holyoke, Massachusetts, is on the other side of what you call the tofu curtain. So there's a part of Western Massachusetts that's very progressive, and there's a lot of liberal arts colleges there and a lot of farmers markets and progressive thinking. And then you've got these other cities that have a lot of the urban problems like drugs and gangs and things like that. And Holyoke is a place with a lot of immigrants, a lot of Puerto Rican residents. And one of the things that is so cool about that is that these folks grew up actually farming themselves. And so to get people involved in urban gardening was really easy because that was those were their roots in the first place, Nuestros Raíces.
Yeah, these are the folks who don't look like it. Look at us like we're crazy at all for growing all this stuff. They go, oh, yeah, you can eat that. That's great. You can eat that. That's great. Folks who grew up in the mountains in Puerto Rico, and the folks here mostly all grew up in these two tiny towns in the mountains of Puerto Rico, grew up foraging for passion fruits and wild yams and grew up on these sort of very small subsistence homesteads, really, and have really an excellent living tradition of an agricultural culture. And the folks who, their children and their grandchildren who grew up here in the city have lost a lot of that. And much of our work at Nuestras Raíces has been passing on that tradition and that knowledge and that part of the culture to the younger generations of folks who are growing up here in the city.
There's a very important thing to talk about, which is the relationship between agriculture, food supply, permaculture, all those things, and social justice. Talk about that and the work that you're doing there.
Well, in terms of our garden, it's not so directly linked, I think, but in terms of the bigger picture, the work of Nuestras Raíces has really been about addressing food security issues in the city, about addressing some of the challenges that affect the community, like obesity and diabetes, in part through agriculture and increased production and consumption of vegetables. I feel like permaculture is a great set of tools, but for them to be fully realized, we want them to be in the hands of communities, especially communities who are hard hit or frontline communities like this community in Holyoke, to be a tool for self-determination. So a tool for people to be able to have their own capacity to produce food and energy and housing for themselves, to produce jobs. One of the things we've done here in town with Nuestras Raíces is we ran a training program with kids who are coming out of the juvenile justice system and trained them to install solar hot water systems. We ended up spinning off a company that does solar hot water installs, among other things. And they've hired 5 or 6 kids who've come out of that program to work for them. So now we're making the city greener and providing jobs in a community that is in desperate need of employment. So we're providing green employment and training in that community. And that's a really exciting opportunity. And eventually that business will be providing revenue for, it's breaking even now, but eventually it'll be providing revenue for the nonprofit as well, which is a great thing. Anybody who runs a nonprofit knows writing grants all the time is really tedious and time-consuming. And so to have some money-making businesses that are doing something positive is a great opportunity as well.
The book Paradise Lot really makes one think a lot about the food system and local food production. And here you are having this garden on a tenth of an acre that mimics the ecosystems around you very consciously. And a lot of the food that you eat, not all the food, but a lot of the food you eat is from that garden. And you were talking about, like, the carbohydrates that you have to buy. You know, you're buying bread. You're not growing wheat there. But if you thought about it and did it and planned it consciously, you could have nut trees and all kinds of other actually food-bearing plants and trees and so on in a city planned as part of even a real estate development that would provide ever more food for the inhabitants of that city. I find that amazing and very important and fascinating.
I'm really enthusiastic about this. I think edible street trees are a great idea, and especially if you were to look at street trees that provide some kind of staple crop, even, you know, so much better. In our case, in our backyard, we have too much shade to and not enough space to grow a lot of nut trees. But you could do as street trees in our town, you could grow lots of chestnuts, which would be, I calculated something like, it would be enough to grow something like 35 or 40 loaf of bread equivalents for everyone on the street if we just had planted them instead of silly maple trees and stuff that we have out there right now. That's pretty interesting. A great example of someone who's done that is Brad Lancaster in Tucson, Arizona, who's installed these rainwater capturing earthworks along the streets to catch road runoff and grow mesquite trees, which is a native nitrogen-fixing staple food that grows on a tree, which is just awesome. And they've really used that as a way to transform neighborhoods and build community and get people talking about water and food and other issues while having parties and using their, you know, hammer mill to grind the mesquite pods and having a big mesquite pancake breakfast together. I think that's a great, great model of community organizing around permaculture.
Moving on to the bigger picture, how does the kind of work that you guys are doing in permaculture and all the people that you're associating with, how does that speak to issues, for example, of climate change?
That's the issue that has me most worked up at this point that I'm really thinking about. I'm about to launch a Kickstarter campaign about that in just a couple of days for a book I'm working on that's looking at these kinds of perennial agriculture, what we call regenerative agriculture, that is soil-building agricultural practices, mostly with perennials. What's the potential impact of that on climate change? Because we need to not only reduce our emissions of fossil fuels, but we need to actively sequester carbon, 200 or more gigatons of carbon need to be pulled out of the atmosphere. And a great place to hold that carbon is perennial vegetation like trees and non-tilled soil, which can hold a lot of organic matter. So I'm looking at what are the perennial staple crops of the world? What could we replace or supplement wheat and corn and soybeans with? Products that grow on trees, and what's the current state of domestication of those crops? Basically, in the tropics, they're awesome, and in the colder climates, they're not as good, and people are working on it. What's the toolkit of practices and species that we can use to sort of save the planet from disastrous climate change by turning it into an edible paradise? And I find that a very compelling and interesting vision.
Yes, indeed. I mean, it's the ultimate win-win kind of model.
I think so. And if you were to compare that to the kinds of geoengineering projects people are talking about, which we may need and we may be glad for, but, you know, giant orbiting solar mirrors and these, and, you know, airplanes to spray sulfur in the sky to increase albedo and stuff like that. Those are projects that we could look at and we could assess their multiple benefits and say, are they helping the world's poorest people to become more self-reliant, yes or no? Are they increasing or shrinking the gap between wealthy and poor? Are they providing benefits for agriculture? Are they providing benefits for soil stabilization? Are they restoring degraded land? Are they feeding people? And we would look at multifunctional regenerative agriculture, and it would win a lot of those conversations. There's a lot of challenges involved in converting a quarter of the world's surface to a new kind of agriculture. It's a big challenge, but I think it's a really essential. We have to beat climate change, to stabilize the climate, we have to transform every aspect of how we live our lives. And agriculture is a big component of that. I'm also looking at these industrial crops. Much of the petroleum that we use on a daily basis is not for fuel, but is in the form of plastic and fibers and synthetic rubber. And how can we use plants to serve as the basis of sort of a bio industry? It turns out you can make some kinds of bioplastic in your kitchen with cornstarch, gelatin, and glycerol.
Really? You
can have all kinds. And so what's the right scale, you know, for some of these technologies? Some can be done on a much more decentralized basis. So I'm sort of imagining, throughout, let's say, the tropical developing world, these village-level or municipal-level, community-level bioplastic facilities that make non-toxic, bio-based, biodegradable plastics, compostable plastics, And there's this amazing tree called the diesel tree, which you can tap like maple syrup, but what comes out, you run through a filter and you can put it right in a diesel engine and run a diesel engine.
Amazing.
That's pretty cool. We don't have anything like that up here yet, although the most promising candidate for a hydrocarbon crop in cold climates are milkweeds, which I know you have as many of out here, as out where you are, as we do out here.
Right, right.
They're very high in long-chain hydrocarbons in the latex. They make excellent fiber crops as well. So there's some effort afoot to domesticate milkweed and develop it as a new crop to substitute for petroleum, which I think is really cool.
We're talking to Eric Tonesmeyer about his book, Paradise Lot, Two Plant Geeks, One-Tenth of an Acre, and the Making of an Edible Garden Oasis in the City. Eric, why should people get on the telephone right now and call KSFR and make a contribution?
Well, I think of it as community-supported radio. If it's something that you want, that you think is important, that matters to you and to your community, it's sort of part of being a citizen at this point in history in this country, is helping to make that contribution to things that matter to you, like public radio.